nothing and nothing they could do to change it. Even the captain was quiet, for there was no command or plan he knew that could put things back together again. Oh, it's a long way down. Oh, it's a long way down, a long, long, long way down, said a voice. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. It's a long way down.
Who's that?
I don't know. Stimson, I think. Stimson, is that you?
It's a long, long way, and I don't like it. Oh, God, I don't like it.
Stimson, this is Hollis. Stimson, you hear me? A pause while they fell separate from one another. Stimson?
Yes,
he replied at last. Stimson, take it easy. We're all in the same fix.
I don't want to be here. I want to be somewhere else.
There's a chance we'll be found.
I must be. I must be,
said Stimson.
I don't believe this. I don't believe any of this is happening.
It's a bad dream, said someone. Shut up, said Hollis. Come and make me, said the voice. It was Applegate. He laughed easily with a similar objectivity. Come and shut me up. Hollis for the first time felt the impossibility of his position. A great anger filled him, for he wanted more than anything at this moment to be able to do something to Applegate. He had wanted for many years to do something, and now it was too late. Applegate was only a telephonic voice. Falling, falling, falling. Now, as if they had discovered the horror, two of the men began to scream. In a nightmare, Hollis saw one of them float by, very near, screaming and screaming. Stop it! The man was almost at his fingertips, screaming insanely. He would never stop. He would go on screaming for a million miles, as long as he was in radio range, disturbing all of them, making it impossible for them to talk to one another. Hollis reached out. It was best this way. He made the extra effort and touched the man. He grasped the man's ankle and pulled himself up along the body until he reached the head. The man screamed and clawed frantically like a drowning swimmer. The screaming filled the universe. One way or the other, thought Hollis. The moon or earth or meteors will kill him, so why not now? He smashed the man's glass mask with his iron fist. The screaming stopped. He pushed off from the body and let it spin away on its own course. Falling. Falling, falling down space, Hollis and the rest of them went in the long, endless dropping and whirling of silence. Hollis, you still there? Hollis did not speak, but felt the rush of heat in his face. This is Applegate again. All right, Applegate. Let's talk. We haven't anything else to do. The captain cut in. That's enough of that. We've got to figure a way out of this. Captain, why don't you shut up? Said Applegate. What? You heard me, Captain. Don't pull your rank on me. You're 10,000 miles away by now, and let's not kid ourselves. As Stimson puts it, it's a long way down. See here, Applegate, can it? This is a mutiny of one. I haven't a damn thing to lose. Your ship was a bad ship, and you were a bad captain, and I hope you break when you hit the moon. I'm ordering you to stop. Go on, order me again. Applegate smiled across 10,000 miles. The captain was silent. Applegate continued. Where were we, Hollis? Oh, yes, I remember. I hate you, too. But you know that. You've known it for a long time. Hollis clenched his fists helplessly. I want to tell you something, said Applegate. Make you happy. I was the one who blackballed you with the rocket company 5 years ago. A meteor flashed by. Hollis looked down and his left hand was gone. Blood spurted. Suddenly, there was no air in his suit. He had enough air in his lungs to move his right hand over and twist a knob at his left elbow, tightening the joint and sealing the leak. It had happened so quickly that he was not surprised. Nothing surprised him anymore. The air in the suit came back to normal in an instant now that the leak was sealed, and the blood that had flowed so swiftly was pressured as he fastened the knob yet tighter until it made a tourniquet. All of this took place in a terrible silence on his part, and the other men chatted. The one man, Lespere, went on and on with his talk about his wife on Mars, his wife on Venus, his wife on Jupiter, his money, his wondrous times, his drunkenness, his gambling, his happiness, on and on while they all fell. Lespere reminisced on the past, happy while he fell to his death. It was so very odd. Space, thousands of miles of space, and these voices vibrating in the center of it. No one visible at all, and only the radio waves quivering and trying to quicken other men into emotion.
Are you angry, Hollis?
No. And he was not. The abstraction has returned, and he was a thing of dull concrete, forever falling nowhere. You wanted to get to the top all your life, Hollis. You always wondered what happened. I put the black mark on you just before I was tossed out myself. That isn't important, said Hollis. And it was not. It was gone. When life is over, it is like a flicker of bright film, an instant on the screen. All of its prejudices and passions condensed and illumined for an instant on space, and before you could cry out, there was a happy day, there a bad one, there an evil face, there a good one, the film burned to a cinder. The screen went dark. From this outer edge of his life, looking back, there was only one remorse, and that was only that he wished to go on living. Did all dying people feel this way? As if they had never lived? Did life seem that short, indeed, over and done, before you took a breath? Did it seem this abrupt and impossible to everyone, or only to himself, here, now, with a few hours left to him for thought and deliberation? One of the other men, Lespere, was talking. Well, I had me a good time. I had a wife on Mars, Venus, and Jupiter. Each of them had money and treated me swell. I got drunk, and once I gambled away $20,000. But you're here now, thought Hollis. I didn't have any of those things. When I was living, I was jealous of you, Lespere. When I had another day ahead of me, I envied you, your women, and your good times. Women frightened me, and I went into space, always wanting them and jealous of you for having them, and money, and as much happiness as you could have in your own wild way. But now, falling here, with everything over, I'm not jealous of you anymore, because it's over for you as it is for me, and right now it's like it never was. Hollis craned his face forward and shouted into the telephone, "It's all over, Lespere!" Silence. It's just as if it never was, Lespere. Who's that? Lespere's faltering voice. This is Hollis. He was being mean. He felt the meanness, the senseless meanness of dying. Applegate had hurt him, now he wanted to hurt another. Applegate and space had both wounded him. You're out here, Lespere. It's all over. It's just as if it had never happened, isn't it?
No.
When anything's over, it's just like it never happened. Where's your life any better than mine now? Now is what counts. Is it any better? Is it? Yes, it's better. How? Because I got my thoughts. I remember, cried Lespere, far away, indignant, holding his memories to his chest with both hands. And he was right. With a feeling of cold water rushing through his head and body, Hollis knew he was right. There were differences between memories and dreams. He had only dreams of things he had wanted to do, while Lespierre had memories of things done and accomplished, and this knowledge began to pull Hollis apart with a slow, quivering precision. "What good does it do you?" he cried to Lespierre. "Now, when a thing's over, it's not good anymore. You're no better off than me."
"I'm resting easy," said Lespierre. "I've had my turn. I'm not getting mean at the end. Like you."
"Mean?" Hollis turned the word on his tongue. He had never been mean. As long as he could remember, in his life, he had never dared to be mean. He must have saved it all of these years for such a time as this. "Mean." He rolled the word into the back of his mind. He felt tears start into his eyes and roll down his face. Someone must have heard his gasping voice. "Take it easy, Hollis." It was, of course, ridiculous. Only a minute before he had been giving advice to others, to Stimson. He had felt a braveness, which he had thought to be the genuine thing, and now he knew that it had been nothing but shock and the objectivity possible in shock. Now he was trying to pack a lifetime of suppressed emotion into an interval of minutes.
"I know how you feel, Hollis," said Lespierre, now 20,000 miles away, his voice fading. "I don't take it personally."
"But aren't we equal," he wondered, "Lespierre and I, here, now? If a thing's over, it's done, and what good is it? You die anyway." But he knew he was rationalizing, for it was like trying to tell the difference between a live man and a corpse. There was a spark in one and not in the other, an aura, a mysterious element. So it was with Lespierre and himself. Lespierre had lived a good full life, and it made him a different man now, and he, Hollis, had been as good as dead for many years. They came to death by separate paths, and, in all likelihood, if there were kinds of death, their kinds would be as different as night from day. The quality of death, like that of life, must be of an infinite variety, and if one has already died once, then what was there to look for in dying for good and all, as he was now? It was a second later that he discovered his right foot was cut sheer away. It almost made him laugh. The air was gone from his suit again. He bent quickly, and there was blood. And the meteor had taken flesh and suit away to the ankle. Oh, death in space was most humorous. It cut you away piece by piece like a black and invisible butcher. He tightened the valve at the knee, his head whirling into pain, fighting to remain aware. And with the valve tightened, the blood retained, the air kept. He straightened up and went on falling, falling, for that was all there was left to do.
"Hollis."
Hollis nodded sleepily, tired of waiting for death.
"This is Applegate again," said the voice.
"Yes?"
"I've had time to think. I listened to you. This isn't good. It makes us bad. This is a bad way to die. It brings all the bile out. You listening, Hollis?"
"Yes."
"I lied. A minute ago. I lied. I didn't blackball you. I don't know why I said that. Guess I wanted to hurt you. You seemed the one to hurt. We've always fought. Guess I'm getting old fast and repenting fast. I guess listening to you be mean made me ashamed. Whatever the reason, I want you to know I was an idiot, too. There's not an ounce of truth in what I said. To hell with you. Hollis felt his heart begin to work again. It seemed as if it hadn't worked for 5 minutes, but now all of his limbs began to take color and warmth. The shock was over, and the successive shocks of anger and terror and loneliness were passing. He felt like a man emerging from a cold shower in the morning, ready for breakfast and a new day. Thanks, Applegate. Don't mention it. Up your nose, you bastard.
Hey, said Stone.
What? Hollis called across space, for Stone, of all of them, was a good friend.
I've got myself into a meteor swarm. Some little asteroids.
Meteors?
I think it's the Myrmidon cluster that goes out past Mars and in toward Earth once every 5 years. I'm right in the middle. It's like a big kaleidoscope. You get all kinds of colors and shapes and sizes. God, it's beautiful. All that metal.
Silence.
I'm going with them, said Stone. They're taking me off with them. I'll be damned, he laughed.
Hollis looked to see, but saw nothing. There were only the great diamonds and sapphires and emerald mists and velvet inks of space, with God's voice mingling among the crystal fires. There was a kind of wonder and imagination in the thought of Stone going off in the meteor swarm, out past Mars for years and coming in toward Earth every 5 years, passing in and out of the planet's ken for the next million centuries. Stone and the Myrmidon cluster eternal and unending, shifting and shaping like the kaleidoscope colors when you were a child and held the long tube to the sun and gave it a twirl.
So long, Hollis.
Stone's voice, very faint now.
So long.
Good luck, shouted Hollis across 30,000 miles.
Don't be funny,
said Stone, and was gone. The stars closed in. Now all the voices were fading, each on his own trajectory, some to Mars, others into farthest space. And Hollis himself. He looked down. He, of all the others, was going back to Earth, alone.
So long.
Take it easy. So long, Hollis. That was Applegate. The many goodbyes, the short farewells. And now the great loose brain was disintegrating. The components of the brain which had worked so beautifully and efficiently in the skull case of the rocket ship firing through space were dying one by one. The meaning of their life together was falling apart. And as a body dies when the brain ceases functioning, so the spirit of the ship and their long time together and what they meant to one another was dying. Applegate was now no more than a finger blown from the parent body, no longer to be despised and worked against. The brain was exploded, and the senseless, useless fragments of it were far scattered. The voices faded, and now all of space was silent. Hollis was alone, falling. They were all alone. Their voices had died like echoes of the words of God spoken and vibrating in the starred deep. There went the captain to the moon. There, Stone with the meteor swarm. There Stimpson, there Applegate toward Pluto, there Smith and Turner and Underwood, and all the rest, the shards of the kaleidoscope that had formed a thinking pattern for so long, hurled apart. And I, thought Hollis, what can I do?
Is there anything I can do now to make up for a terrible and empty life? If only I could do one good thing to make up for the meanness I collected all these years and didn't even know was in me. But there's no one here but myself, and how can you do good all alone? You can't. Tomorrow night, I'll hit Earth's atmosphere. I'll burn, he thought, and be scattered in ashes all over the continental lands. I'll be put to use. Just a little bit, but ashes are ashes, and they'll add to the land. He fell swiftly, like a bullet, like a pebble, like an iron weight, objective, objective all of the time now, not sad or happy or anything, but only wishing he could do a good thing now, that everything was gone, a good thing for just himself to know about. When I hit the atmosphere, I'll burn like a meteor. I wonder, he said, if anyone'll see me. The small boy on the country road looked up and screamed, "Look, Mom, look! A falling star!" The blazing white star fell down the sky of dusk in Illinois. "Make a wish," said his mother. "Make a wish." The illustrated man turned in the moonlight. He turned again, and again, and again. The Other Foot. When they heard the news, they came out of the restaurants and cafes and hotels and looked at the sky. They lifted their dark hands over their upturned white eyes. Their mouths hung wide. In the hot noon, for thousands of miles, there were little towns where the dark people stood with their shadows under them, looking up. In her kitchen, Hattie Johnson covered the boiling soup, wiped her thin fingers on a cloth, and walked carefully to the back porch.
"Come on, Ma! Hey, Ma, come on! You'll miss it! Hey, Mom!"
Three little Negro boys danced around in the dusty yard, yelling. Now and then they looked at the house frantically.
"I'm coming," said Hattie, and opened the screen door. "Where you hear this rumor?" "Up at Jones's, Ma. They say a rocket's coming, first one in 20 years, with a white man in it."
"What's a white man? I never seen one."
"You'll find out," said Hattie. "Yes, indeed, you'll find out."
"Tell us about one, Ma. Tell like you did."
Hattie frowned.
"Well, it's been a long time. I was a little girl, you see. That was back in 1965.
"Tell us about a white man, Mom."
She came and stood in the yard, looking up at the blue, clear Martian sky with the thin white Martian clouds, and in the distance the Martian hills broiling in the heat. She said at last,
"Well, first of all, they got white hands."
"White hands?"
the boys joked, slapping each other.
"And they got white arms."
"White arms?"
hooted the boys.
"And white faces."
"White faces? Really? White like this, Mom?"
The smallest threw dust on his face, sneezing.
"This way?"
"Whiter than that,"
she said gravely, and turned to the sky again. There was a troubled thing in her eyes, as if she was looking for a thunder shower up high, and not seeing it made her worry.
"Maybe you better go inside."
"Oh, Mom!"
They stared at her in disbelief.
"We got to watch. We just got to. Nothing's going to happen, is it?"
"I don't know. I got a feeling is all.
We just want to see the ship and maybe run down to the port and see that white man. What's he like, huh, Mom?"
"I don't know. I just don't know,"
she mused, shaking her head.
"Tell us some more."
"Well,
The white people live on Earth, which is where we all come from 20 years ago. We just up and walked away and came to Mars, and sat down and built towns, and here we are. Now we're Martians instead of Earth people. And no white men have come up here in all that time. That's the story.
Why didn't they come up, Mom?
Well, 'cause right after we got up here, Earth got in an atom war. They blew each other up terribly. They forgot us. When they finished fighting after years, they didn't have any rockets. Took them until recently to build more. So here they come now, 20 years later, to visit. She gazed at her children numbly and then began to walk.
You wait here. I'm going down the line to Elizabeth Brown's house.
You promise to stay?
We don't want to, but we will.
All right, then. And she ran off down the road. At the Browns, she arrived in time to see everybody packed into the family car.
Hey there, Hattie, come on along.
Where are you going? She said, breathlessly running up.
To see the white man.
That's right, said Mr. Brown seriously. He waved at his load. These children never saw one, and I almost forgot.
What you going to do with that white man? Asked Hattie.
Do? Said everyone.
Why, just look at him is all.
You sure?
What else can we do?
I don't know, said Hattie. I just thought there might be trouble.
What kind of trouble?
You know, said Hattie vaguely, embarrassed. You ain't going to lynch him.
Lynch him?
Everyone laughed. Mr. Brown slapped his knee. Why, bless you, child, no. We're going to shake his hand. Ain't we, everyone?
Sure, sure.
Another car drove up from another direction, and Hattie gave a cry.
Willie!
What you doing way down here?
Where are the kids? Shouted her husband angrily. He glared at the others.
You going down like a bunch of fools to see that man come in?
That appears to be just right, agreed Mr. Brown, nodding and smiling.
Well, take your guns along, said Willie. I'm on my way home for mine right now.
Willie!
You get in this car, Hattie.
He held the door open firmly, looking at her until she obeyed. Without another word to the others, he roared the car down the dusty road.
Willie, not so fast.
Not so fast, huh? We'll see about that.
He watched the road tear under the car.
What right they got coming up here this late? Why don't they leave us in peace? Why didn't they blow themselves up on that old world and let us be?
Willie, that ain't no Christian way to talk.
I'm not feeling Christian, he said savagely, gripping the wheel. I'm just feeling mean. After all them years of doing what they did to our folks, my mom and dad, and your mom and dad, you remember? You remember how they hung my father on Knockwood Hill and shot my mother? You remember? Or you got a memory that's short like the others?
I remember, she said.
You remember Dr. Phillips and Mr. Burton and their big houses and my mother's washing shack and dad working when he was old? And the thanks he got was being hung by Dr. Phillips and Mr. Burton. Well, said Willie, the shoe's on the other foot now. We'll see who gets laws passed against him, who gets lynched, who rides the back of streetcars, who gets segregated in shows. We'll just wait and see.
Oh, Willie, you're talking trouble.
Everybody's talking. Everybody's thought on this day, thinking it'd never be, thinking, what kind of day would it be if the white man ever came up here to Mars? But here's the day, and we can't run away.
Ain't you going to let the white people live up here?
Sure,
he smiled, but it was a wide, mean smile, and his eyes were mad. They can come up and live and work here. Why, certainly. All they got to do to deserve it is live in their own small part of town, the slums, and shine our shoes for us, and mop up our trash, and sit in the last row in the balcony. That's all we ask. And once a week, we hang one or two of them. Simple.
You don't sound human, and I don't like it.
You'll have to get used to it, he said. He braked the car to a stop before the house and jumped out. Find my guns and some rope. We'll do this right.
Oh, Willie!
She wailed, and just sat there in the car while he ran up the steps and slammed the front door. She went along. She didn't want to go along, but he rattled around in the attic, cursing like a crazy man until he found four guns. She saw the brutal metal of them glittering in the black attic, and she couldn't see him at all. He was so dark. She heard only his swearing. And at last his long legs came climbing down from the attic in a shower of dust, and he stacked up bunches of brass shells and blew out the gun chambers and clicked shells into them, his face stern and heavy and folded in upon the gnawing bitterness there. Leave us alone, he kept muttering, his hands flying away from him suddenly, uncontrolled. Leave us blame alone, why don't they?
Willie, Willie,
you too, you too! And he gave her the same look, and a pressure of his hatred touched her mind. Outside the window the boys gabbled to each other.
White as milk, she said. White as milk.
White as this old flower, you see.
White as a stone, like chalk you write with.
Willie plunged out of the house. You children come inside, I'm locking you up. You ain't seeing no white man. You ain't talking about them. You ain't doing nothing. Come on now.
But Daddy...
He shoved them through the door and went and fetched a bucket of paint and a stencil, and from the garage a long, thick, hairy rope coil into which he fashioned a hangman's knot, very carefully watching the sky while his hands felt their way at their task. And then they were in the car, leaving bowls of dust behind them down the road.
Slow up, Willie.
This is no slowing up time, he said. This is a hurrying time, and I'm hurrying. All along the road people were looking up in the sky, or climbing in their cars, or riding in cars, and guns were sticking up out of some cars like telescopes, sighting all the evils of a world coming to an end. She looked at the guns.
You've been talking,
she accused her husband. That's what I've been doing, he grunted, nodding. He watched the road fiercely. I stopped at every house and I told them what to do, to get their guns, to get paint, to bring rope, and be ready. And here we all are, the welcoming committee, to give them the key to the city. Yes, sir! She pressed her thin, dark hands together to push away the terror growing in her now. And she felt the car bucket and lurch around other cars. She heard the voices yelling, Hey, Willie, look! And hands holding up ropes and guns as they rushed by, and mouths smiling at them in the swift rushing. Here we are, said Willie, and braked the car into dusty halting and silence. He kicked the door open with a big foot and, laden with weapons, stepped out, lugging them across the airport meadow.
Have you thought, Willie?
That's all I'd done for 20 years. I was 16 when I left Earth, and I was glad to leave. He said. There wasn't anything there for me or you or anybody like us. I've never been sorry I left. We've had peace here, the first time we ever drew a solid breath. Now come on. He pushed through the dark crowd which came to meet him.
Willie, Willie, what we gonna do? They said.
Here's a gun, he said. Here's a gun. Here's another. He passed them out with savage jabs of his arms. Here's a pistol. Here's a shotgun. The people were so close together it looked like one dark body with 1,000 arms reaching out to take the weapons.
Willie! Willie!
His wife stood tall and silent by him, her fluted lips pressed shut and her large eyes wet and tragic.
Bring the paint, he said to her. And she lugged a gallon can of yellow paint across the field to where, at that moment, a trolley car was pulling up with a fresh-painted sign on its front,
to the White Man's Landing, full of talking people who got off and ran across the meadow, stumbling, looking up. Women with picnic boxes, men with straw hats, in shirt sleeves. The streetcar stood humming and empty. Willie climbed up, set the paint cans down, opened them, stirred the paint, tested a brush, drew forth a stencil, and climbed up on a seat.
Hey there! The conductor came around behind him, his coin changer jangling. What do you think you're doing? Get down off there! You see what I'm doing? Keep your shirt on. And Willie began the stenciling in yellow paint. He dabbed on an F and an O and an R with terrible pride in his work. And when he finished it, the conductor squinted up and read the fresh, glinting yellow words. For whites, rear section. He read it again. For whites, he blinked, rear section. The conductor looked at Willie and began to smile.
Does that suit you?
Asked Willie, stepping down.
Said the conductor, that suits me just fine, sir.
Hattie was looking at the sign from outside and holding her hands over her breasts. Willie returned to the crowd, which was growing now, taking sighs from every auto that groaned to a halt and every new trolley car which squealed around the bend from the nearby town. Willie climbed up on a packing box.
Let's have a delegation to paint every street car in the next hour. Volunteers?
Hands leapt up.
Get going.
They went.
Let's have a delegation to fix theater seats. Roped off. The last two rows for whites.
More hands.
Go on.
They ran off. Willie peered around, bubbled with perspiration, panting with exertion, proud of his energy, his hands on his wife's shoulder, who stood under him, looking at the ground with her downcast eyes.
Let's see now, he declared. Oh, yes, we got to pass a law this afternoon. No intermarriages.
That's right, said a lot of people.
All shoeshine boys quit their jobs today.
Quitting right now. Some men threw down the rags they carried in their excitement all across town.
Got to pass a minimum wage law, don't we?
Sure.
Pay them white folks at least 10 cents an hour.
That's right.
The mayor of the town hurried up.
Now look here, Willie Johnson. Get down off that box. Mayor, I can't be made to do nothing like that. You're making a mob, Willie Johnson. That's the idea. The same thing you always hated when you were a kid. You know better than some of those white men you yell about.
This is the other shoe, Mayor.
And the other foot,
said Willie, not even looking at the mayor, looking at the faces beneath him. Some of them smiling, some of them doubtful, others bewildered, some of them reluctant and drawing away, fearful.
You'll be sorry, said the mayor.
We'll have an election and get a new mayor, said Willie. And he glanced off at the town where up and down the street signs were being hung, fresh painted, limited clientele, right to serve customer revocable at any time. He grinned and slapped his hands. Lord! And streetcars were being halted and sections being painted white in back to suggest their future inhabitants, and theaters were being invaded and roped off by chuckling men while their wives stood wondering on the curbs and children were spanked into houses to be hid away from this awful time.
Are we all ready?
Called Willie Johnson, the rope in his hands with the noose tied and neat.
Ready!
Shouted half the crowd. The other half murmured and moved like figures in a nightmare in which they wished no participation.
Here it comes,
called a small boy. Like marionette heads on a single string, the heads of the crowd turned upward. Across the sky, very high and beautiful, a rocket burned on a sweep of orange fire. It circled and came down, causing all to gasp. It landed, setting the meadow afire here and there. The fire burned out, the rocket lay a moment in quiet, and then, as the silent crowd watched, a great door in the side of the vessel whispered out a breath of oxygen. The door slid back, and an old man stepped out.
A white man! A white man! A white man!
The words traveled back in the expectant crowd, the children speaking in each other's ears, whispering, butting each other. The words moving in ripples to where the crowd stopped and the streetcars stood in the windy sunlight, the smell of paint coming out their opened windows. The whispering wore itself away and it was gone. No one moved.
The white man was tall and straight, but a deep weariness was in his face. He had not shaved this day, and his eyes were as old as the eyes of a man can be and still be alive. His eyes were colorless, almost white and sightless with things he had seen in the passing years. He was as thin as a winter bush. His hands trembled, and he had to lean against the portway of the ship as he looked out over the crowd. He put out a hand and half-smiled, but drew his hand back. No one moved. He looked down into their faces, and perhaps he saw, but did not see, the guns and the ropes, and perhaps he smelled the paint. No one ever asked him. He began to talk. He started very quietly and slowly, expecting no interruptions, and receiving none, and his voice was very tired and old and pale. "It doesn't matter who I am," he said. "I'd be just a name to you anyhow. I don't know your names either. That'll come later." He paused, closed his eyes for a moment, and then continued. 20 years ago you left Earth. That's a long, long time. It's more like 20 centuries, so much has happened. After you left, the war came. He nodded slowly. Yes, the big one. The third one. It went on for a long time. Until last year. We bombed all of the cities of the world. We destroyed New York and London and Moscow and Paris and Shanghai and Bombay and Alexandria. We ruined it all. And when we finished with the big cities, we went to the little cities and atom bombed and burned them. Now he began to name cities and places and streets. And as he named them, a murmur rose up in his audience. We destroyed Natchez. A murmur. And Columbus, Georgia. Another murmur. We burned New Orleans. A sigh. And Atlanta. Still another. And there was nothing left of Greenwater, Alabama. Willie Johnson jerked his head, and his mouth opened. Hattie saw this gesture, and the recognition coming into his dark eyes. "Nothing was left," said the old man in the port, speaking slowly. "Cotton fields burned." "Oh," said everyone. "Cotton mills bombed out." "Oh." "And the factories, radioactive. Everything radioactive. All the roads and the farms and the foods, radioactive. Everything." He named more names of towns and villages. Tampa. "That's my town," someone whispered. "Fulton." "That's mine," someone else said. "Memphis." "Memphis? Did they burn Memphis?" a shocked query. "Memphis. Blown up." "Fourth Street in Memphis?" "All of it," said the old man. It was stirring them now. After 20 years it was rushing back. The towns and the places, the trees and the brick buildings, the signs and the churches and the familiar stores, all of it was coming to the surface among the gathered people. Each name touched memory, and there was no one present without a thought of another day. They were all old enough for that, save the children. Laredo.
"I remember Laredo."
"New York City."
"I had a store in Harlem."
"Harlem bombed out."
The ominous words. The familiar, remembered places. The struggle to imagine all of those places in ruins.
Willie Johnson murmured the words, "Greenwater, Alabama. That's where I was born. I remember." "Gone. All of it gone. The man said so." The man continued.
So we destroyed everything and ruined everything like the fools that we were and the fools that we are. We killed millions. I don't think there are more than 500,000 people left in the world, all kinds and types. And out of all the wreckage, we salvaged enough metal to build this one rocket, and we came to Mars in it this month to seek your help.
He hesitated and looked down among the faces to see what could be found there, but he was uncertain. Hattie Johnson felt her husband's arm tense, saw his fingers grip the rope.
"We've been fools," said the old man quietly. "We've brought the earth and civilization down about our heads. None of the cities are worth saving. They'll be radioactive for a century. Earth is over and done with. Its age is through. You have rockets here which you haven't tried to use to return to Earth in 20 years. Now I've come to ask you to use them. To come to Earth. To pick up the survivors and bring them back to Mars. To help us go on at this time. We've been stupid. Before God, we admit our stupidity and our evilness. All the Chinese and the Indians and the Russians and the British and the Americans, we're asking to be taken in. Your Martian soil has lain fallow for numberless centuries. There's room for everyone. It's good soil. I've seen your fields from above. We'll come and work it for you. Yes, we'll even do that. We deserve anything you want to do to us, but don't shut us out. We can't force you to act now. If you want, I'll get into my ship and go back, and that will be all there is to it. We won't bother you again. But we'll come here and we'll work for you and do the things you did for us. Clean your houses, cook your meals, shine your shoes, and humble ourselves in the sight of God for the things we have done over the centuries to ourselves, to others, to you.
He was finished. There was a silence of silences, a silence you could hold in your hand, and a silence that came down like a pressure of a distant storm over the crowd. Their long arms hung like dark pendulums in the sunlight, and their eyes were upon the old man, and he did not move now, but waited. Willie Johnson held the rope in his hands. Those around him watched to see what he might do. His wife Hattie waited, clutching his arm. She wanted to get at the hate of them all, to pry at it and work at it until she found a little chink, and then pull out a pebble or a stone or a brick, and then a part of the wall, and, once started, the whole edifice might roar down and be done away with. It was teetering now. But which was the keystone, and how to get at it? How to touch them and get a thing started and all of them to make a ruin of their hate? She looked at Willie there in the strong silence, and the only thing she knew about the situation was him, and his life, and what had happened to him. And suddenly he was the keystone. Suddenly she knew that if he could be pried loose, then the thing in all of them might be loosened and torn away. "Mister?" She stepped forward. She didn't even know the first words to say. The crowd stared at her back. She left them staring. "Mister?" The man turned to her with a tired smile. "Mister," she said. "Do you know Knockwood Hill in Greenwater, Alabama?" The old man spoke over his shoulder to someone within the ship. A moment later, a photographic map was handed out, and the man held it, waiting. "You know the big oak on top of that hill, mister?" the big oak, the place where Willie's father was shot and hung and found swinging in the morning wind.
Yes.
Is that still there? Asked Hattie.
It's gone, said the old man. Blown up. The hill's all gone, and the oak tree, too. You see?
He touched the photograph.
Let me see that, said Willie, jerking forward and looking at the map.
Hattie blinked at the white man, heart pounding.
Tell me about Greenwater, she said quickly.
What do you want to know?
About Dr. Phillips. Is he still alive?
A moment in which the information was found in a clicking machine within the rocket.
Killed in the war.
And his son?
Dead.
What about their house?
Burned, like all the other houses.
What about that other big tree on Knockwood Hill?
All the trees went. Burned.
That tree went.
You're sure?
Said Willie.
Yes.
Willie's body loosened somewhat.
And what about that Mr. Burton's house? And Mr. Burton? No houses at all left. No people. You know Mrs. Johnson's washing shack? My mother's place?
The place where she was shot.
That's gone, too. Everything's gone. Here are the pictures you can see for yourself.
The pictures were there to be held and looked at and thought about. The rocket was full of pictures and answers to questions. Any town, any building, any place. Willie stood with the rope in his hands. He was remembering Earth, the green Earth and the green town where he was born and raised, and he was thinking now of that town, gone to pieces, to ruin, blown up and scattered, all of the landmarks with it, all of the supposed or certain evil scattered with it, all of the hard men gone, the stables, the ironsmiths, the curio shops, the soda founts, the gin mills, the river bridges, the lynching trees, the buckshot-covered hills, the roads, the cows, the mimosas, and his own house as well as those big pillared houses down near the long river, those white mortuaries where the women as delicate as moths fluttered in the autumn light, distant, far away. Those houses where the cold men rocked, with glasses of drink in their hands, guns leaned against the porch newels, sniffing the autumn airs and considering death. Gone, all gone, gone and never coming back. Now, for certain, all of that civilization ripped into confetti and strewn at their feet. Nothing, nothing of it left to hate. Not an empty brass gun shell, or a twisted hemp, or a tree, or even a hill of it to hate. Nothing but some alien people in a rocket, people who might shine his shoes and ride in the back of trolleys or sit far up in midnight theaters.
You won't have to do that, said Willie Johnson.
His wife glanced at his big hands. His fingers were opening. The rope released, fell and coiled upon itself along the ground. They ran through the streets of their town and tore down the new signs so quickly made, and painted out the fresh yellow signs on streetcars, and they cut down the ropes in the theater balconies, and unloaded their guns and stacked their ropes away.
A new start for everyone, said Hattie on the way home in their car.
Yes, said Willie at last. The Lord's let us come through, a few here and a few there. And what happens next is up to all of us. The time for being fools is over. We got to be something else except fools. I knew that when he talked. I knew then that now the white man's as lonely as we've always been. He's got no home now, just like we didn't have one for so long. Now everything's even. We can start all over again, on the same level.
He stopped the car and sat in it, not moving, while Hattie went to let the children out. They ran down to see their father.
"You see the white man? You see him?"
they cried.
"Yes, sir," said Willie, sitting behind the wheel, rubbing his face with his slow fingers. "Seems like for the first time today I really seen the white man. I really seen him clear."
The Highway. The cooling afternoon rain had come over the valley, touching the corn in the tilled mountain fields, tapping on the dry grass roof of the hut. In the rainy darkness, the woman ground corn between cakes of lava rock, working steadily. In the wet lightlessness, somewhere, a baby cried. Hernando stood waiting for the rain to cease so he might take the wooden plow into the field again. Below, the river boiled brown and thickened in its course. The concrete highway, another river, did not flow at all. It lay shining, empty. A car had not come along it in an hour. This was, in itself, of unusual interest. Over the years, there had not been an hour when a car had not pulled up, someone shouting, "Hey there! Can we take your picture?" Someone with a box that clicked, and a coin in his hand. If he walked slowly across the field without his hat, sometimes they called, "Oh, we want you with your hat on!" And they waved their hands, rich with gold things that told time, or identified them, or did nothing at all but winked like spiders' eyes in the sun. So he would turn and go back to get his hat. His wife spoke.
"Something is wrong, Hernando."
"Sí. The road. Something big has happened. Something big to make the road so empty this way."
He walked from the hut slowly and easily, the rain washing over the twined shoes of grass and thick tire rubber he wore. He remembered very well the incident of this pair of shoes. The tire had come into the hut with violence one night, exploding the chickens and the pots apart. It had come alone, rolling swiftly. The car, off which it had come, had rushed on as far as the curve and hung a moment, headlights reflected, before plunging into the river. The car was still there. One might see it on a good day, when the river ran slow and the mud cleared. Deep under, its metal shining, long and low and very rich, lay the car. But then the mud came in again, and you saw nothing. The following day he had carved the shoe soles from the tire rubber. He reached the highway now and stood upon it, listening to the small sounds it made in the rain. Then suddenly, as if at a signal, the cars came, hundreds of them, miles of them, rushing and rushing as he stood by and by him. The big, long black cars, heading north toward the United States, roaring, taking the curves at too great a speed, with a ceaseless blowing and honking. And there was something about the faces of the people packed into the cars, something which dropped him into a deep silence. He stood back to let the cars roar on. He counted them until he tired. 500, 1,000 cars passed, and there was something in the faces of all of them. But they moved too swiftly for him to tell what this thing was. Finally, the silence and emptiness returned. The swift, long, low convertible cars were gone. He heard the last horn fade. The road was empty again. It had been like a funeral cortege, but a wild one, racing, hair out, screaming to some ceremony, ever northward. Why? He could only shake his head and rub his fingers softly at his sides. Now, all alone, a final car.
There was something very, very final about it. Down the mountain road in the thin, cool rain, fuming up great clouds of steam, came an old Ford. It was traveling as swiftly as it might. He expected it to break apart any instant. When this ancient Ford saw Hernando, it pulled up, caked with mud and rusted, the radiator bubbling angrily.
"May we have some water, please, Senor?" A young man, perhaps 21, was driving. He wore a yellow sweater, an open-collared white shirt, and gray pants. In the topless car, the rain fell upon him and 5 young women packed so they could not move in the interior. They were all very pretty, and they were keeping the rain from themselves and the driver with old newspapers. But the rain got through to them, soaking their bright dresses, soaking the young man. His hair was plastered with rain. But they did not seem to care. None complained, and this was unusual. Always before, they complained. Of rain, of heat, of time, of cold, of distance. Hernando nodded.
"I'll bring you water."
"Oh, please hurry,"
one of the girls cried. She sounded very high and afraid. There was no impatience in her, only an asking out of fear. For the first time, Hernando ran when a tourist asked. Always before, he had walked slower at such requests. He returned with a hub lid full of water. This, too, had been a gift from the highway. One afternoon it had sailed like a flung coin into his field, round and glittering. The car to which it belonged had slid on, oblivious to the fact that it had lost a silver eye. Until now, he and his wife had used it for washing and cooking. It made a fine bowl. As he poured the water into the boiling radiator, Hernando looked up at their stricken faces.
"Oh, thank you," said one of the girls. "You don't know what this means."
Hernando smiled.
"So much traffic in this hour. It all goes one way. North."
He did not mean to say anything to hurt them, but when he looked up again, there all of them sat. In the rain, and they were crying. They were crying very hard, and the young man was trying to stop them by laying his hands on their shoulders and shaking them gently, one at a time, but they held their papers over their heads, and their mouths moved, and their eyes were shut, and their faces changed color, and they cried, some loud, some soft. Hernando stood with the half-empty lid in his fingers.
"I did not mean to say anything, senor," he apologized.
"That's all right," said the driver.
"What is wrong, senor?"
"Haven't you heard?" replied the young man.